Good morning, Mr. and Mrs. America. This is Corporal Tim Thornton from the Military Exchange Talk Show. Did you wake up today and say, I'm not living in the America that I grew up in? A 3% tax on tea eventually led to the American Revolution. Now you pay up to 70% of your earnings to a de facto corporate government. You are groped at the airport, surveilled on the street, spied upon in your own home, fed propaganda by the media, lied to by your representatives. Have your rights eroded, your currency devalued, and are we on the verge of an overt police state? Is this a WTF moment, and you're asking yourself, what happened to the home of the brave and the land of the free? Well, at the Military Exchange Talk Show, we address these issues and more. Current events, military topics, veteran right issues, and WTF moments. Civil War Radio with Armin Marinetti and Corporal Tim Fulton.
Honey, how many times do I have to move your old army bag? It's taking up too much room in the closet.
It's a duffel bag. It's full of my old uniforms.
And are you going to wear them again?
Yeah, maybe. Someday.
Uh-huh. And what size do you wear now?
Whatever.
Honey, why don't you take them to Military Mike's? You're certainly there enough.
It's Iron Mike's, and at least he doesn't make comments about my weight.
Bring your old military gear down to Iron Mike's Military Exchange. They'll turn your old uniforms, gear, and military collectibles into cash. So if you drug it back from overseas and it doesn't fit your motif, we want it. Iron Mike's wants your Class A's, Alphas, Hammies, Fatigues, Utilities, Digis. We want your Deuce gear, Molly gear, Alice gear, Web gear. Bring in your Poly Pros, new boots, used boots. Heck, if it's green, camouflaged, or digital, we want it. Give it a good home. Used, pre-enjoyed. Iron Mike's has a bin for it. Iron Mike's buys, sells, and trades. Iron Mike's Military Exchange, located in Canandaigua, New York. Check out all their newly acquired items at militaryexchange.co.
Good morning and welcome to Civil War Radio. This is Corporal Tim Thornton, and I'm here today with Armin Marinetti, Brad Hamilton, Melissa Walker, and Mike Gerger. And we're going to talk about the Anti-Federalist Papers. Armin brought a very big book, so if you're listening to us on Facebook Live or check out the video, you can see the Constitution of the United States of America, Armin's book. How are you, sir?
Good. Good, thank you. Good morning, everybody. Has everybody done their homework? Who's Z? Anybody know who Z is yet?
No, I talked to Reed Robbins.
Yes.
And I think he told me, and I think I forgot.
I don't know. I looked again.
I think he said he had an opinion of who it was.
Okay.
And I tried my best to understand the philosophies of Cato, Brutus, and that went nowhere.
Yeah, we're going to hit on that. Me too. I'm having difficulty as well. How about you?
It's a challenge.
It is a challenge. But I did notice something, though. We are, again, very topical because if you listen to any talk radio, Federalist, 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 Federalist keeps coming up because of what's going on in California, what's going on with this special counsel. I'm not sure if I'm using the right term because I haven't been paying close attention to what's his name, the guy that's doing all the investigation about the Russians.
Would that be Robert Mueller?
Mueller, yeah. I heard just the other day that there's question on whether he's constitutionally legal in what he's doing because the attorney general there recused himself, and the guy that's the backup, he may not even have the authority to appoint Mueller. So, and plus he's limited as to what he can investigate, and he's broadening his scope of the investigation. So what comes up in all that discrepancy? The Federalist Papers.
No kidding.
Yeah, yeah, because they were really concerned. The people that wrote the Federalist and the Anti-Federalist Papers were concerned about a runaway federal government. The state formed the federal government, and now we're to a situation in history where the federal government comes down as the heavy. So that's why we're discussing this stuff. Hopefully people out there can be educated and resist tyranny. Yeah. Ever hear of that word, tyranny? Yeah. It's been around since man, I think. So, all right. So, we don't know who Z is yet. So, people out there, if you're listening, help us out. We don't know who Z he wrote for as an anti-federalist, which means that he wanted, didn't want the U.S. Constitution, right? And they didn't want a big, large central government,
yeah.
Okay, like they had in the Soviet Union back in the 50s, 60s, and 70s.
When he signed his name,
yeah.
Did it was just a big Z or Z-E-E?
I didn't see a hand signature. All I saw was the printed type on a computer screen that said Z with quotation marks. That's all I saw. And the date that he wrote, which was in April of 1787. So I don't know how he actually signed, because you're right. Those letters to the paper back then, because that's where they appeared, the letter from Z would have been handwritten to the newspaper, not typed,
right.
Not sent by computer.
Right.
So he didn't have the means to set up type in the old-fashioned days like Ben Franklin did and send it. So think about that. There's got to be a signature somewhere.
Well, if the original document still exists, right?
That's the question. I don't know if it is in an archive, National Archives. Maybe. You know, maybe that's what I should do is check the National Archives. Yeah. I'm going to stick with my hunch. I think it's George Washington. That's who I think it is. That's why he couldn't reveal his name.
I think what they're failing to remind us, and they wanted us to secretly know, that back then they were still fighting with the zombies. And it's just a little slip in there to remind you that this was going on even back then.
So it was the precursor to World War Z?
Yes.
It was the precursor to World War Z then?
It could be. I swear there's a zombie movie where they involve, like, the Founding Fathers, but...
There has to be.
I'm just having fun.
All right, so just to remind everybody again, this is the Civil War radio segment, and we all remember what that is, right? We're going to be...
Civil.
Yes, which means?
Friendly or...
Mike was locked out until 7:55.
Oh, because he wasn't being civil?
He just stayed out in the parking lot until you saw you when he came in. He's now on what do they call that?
Civil watch. And the war part, we'll leave that to you, Tim.
War is when we do disagree, but... As always, we're supposed to, and we do, we stop when it gets too heated, take a break, relax, and respect each other's views.
Very good.
It tasted terrible saying that.
I could tell he's sweating.
You know, I got to throw in there, and I don't mean to do this, but I watched Fuller House. That's the new remake of Full House. And I watched
Roseanne. Yeah.
And that's... You know, the new Roseanne.
And Goodman, is that his name?
John Goodman.
Yeah,
Roseanne Barr.
Yeah.
And Fuller House, in my opinion, if you're not a far leftist and only a far leftist, then you can just shut it off. It was just total Trump bashing from the opening number. And no rebuttal, no fairness, no jokes to the other side. And I thought it... You know, the funny thing is, these actors that were once good back then don't appear to be that funny anymore.
Mm.
And so last night, we saved it and watched Roseanne.
The old one.
But no, it's the new one.
Okay.
They remade it.
Okay.
And it was more balanced as far as fairness when it comes to jokes.
Okay.
But the actors just didn't really appeal to me like they might have back in the 90s.
Yeah.
So... And not that I got much TV in the 90s. But anyways, at least Roseanne was, you know, like 50% Trump. And then, you know, there was a couple shots over the bow against Trump. But it was sort of funny. It was okay. My mm-hmm. wife laughed more than I did. So, but that's where our culture is. This is like, there's Will and Grace, which is super anti-Trump from what I hear. No surprise there, really. But back in the day, I don't believe that they were. So all these new cultural shows are jumping in and using their time as to shoot over the political views. But they're always rehashed political views.
Hmm.
So they're not really all that interesting. There's something that was said. Like it's like doing a show against memes from last week. Anyways, I digress.
That's all right. I don't watch much TV, so I think... I think that's probably on its way out, television. That's my personal opinion. Might take a few more years, but I think...
A few more years?
Yeah.
Well, modern TV could be gone.
Yeah.
Because it really doesn't hold up to the classics.
Mm-hmm. I agree. So going back to these guys, right, I think as a reminder, again, we have two teams playing here. We have the Federalist Patriots, which are mostly the wealthy people back in the 1780s. Oh. And then we've got, a lot of them are merchants, the political class back then. Then we've got the Anti-Federalist Eagles, which are more along the lines of wealthy farmers, well-to-do farmers from the South, Virginia, even though there are some New Yorkers in there, too, that we talked about, as well as professional people such as doctors back then were considered to be part of this anti-federalist team. And today I thought maybe we might talk a little bit about some of the plays that they used back then. You know, like nowadays we've got the different plays for the football team to try to score. When I played high school football, our coach used to tell us that every play is designed for a touchdown. So if you can get a couple yards out of a play, you didn't do so well. All right, so we had to get at least enough to keep the ball moving.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so... and this is tough to keep the ball moving, but I did come up with a new source that I found, a couple new sources that I found helpful. I went to YouTube because as the time goes by, I'm becoming more and more audio where I have to hear things as well as see things. And there's a guy by the name of Mr. Raymond, R-A-Y-M-O-U-N-D. I think I'm pronouncing it right. He's from Florida, and he has a YouTube series called Mr. Raymond's Civics and Social Studies Academy. So if you punch that into YouTube, you'll probably find a variety of videos with regards to what we discuss on the show here. I wanted to remind everybody that in the Federalist team, they're the Patriots, that we had two well-known names, James Madison and Alexander Hamilton, that didn't always agree, even though they were both Federalists. And sometimes they wrote opposing views in the papers of the day. I did find out that Madison wrote the first 13 essays, or the offensive plays, if you will, for the Federalist Patriots. If you take a look at Federalists 1 through 14, you'll find a focus on, quote, the utility of the Union. So everybody being together, united. That was a big issue at the time because we had opposing views. Sounds a little bit like Civil War radio.
Yeah.
So, and Federalist 15 is a summary of the first 14 Federalist papers. So if you want to try to take a shortcut and go to Federalist 15 and read the first opening paragraphs, you'll get caught up to the first 14 papers.
When they say papers, do they mean like a doctorate or do they mean
essay.
Like pages?
It's an essay. I brought the book with me, so I'll give you an idea. For example, I just turned a page open to Federalist. It looks like 66, if I'm reading my Roman numerals correctly. An L is 50, an X is 10, a V is 5, and an I is 1.
Very good.
So did I do right?
Yes.
Okay, so it's only – this is written by Alexander Hamilton, this one, and there it is right there. It's an essay that appeared in a newspaper.
That's cool.
For its day. So it's – I mean, it's a pretty – good size page, but it's what, four full pages of what would you call that? Opinion on why. Well, this one's titled "Objections to the Power of the Senate to Set as a Court for Impeachments Further Considered." Hmm. So they would put a topic, 57. The Executive Department, again written by Alexander Hamilton, under the pseudonym or the alias of Publius. Okay, so that's what the Federalists were focusing on. Their plays, they wanted the touchdown. Okay, they wanted to score. They wanted to win. So their plays were going for the end zone all the time, and they wanted that U.S. Constitution ratified by at least 9 of the 13 states. Okay? That made it law. Because right now, the Articles of Confederation are still the law of the land. This is all being proposed and moving down that road. And what, you know, when we get to the today's future segment, you know, bring this fast forward, I think I'd like to talk about the Second Amendment, because again, that's in the news, where there's a lot of people saying that we have to repeal the Second Amendment. That's a hefty task. So maybe we could talk a little bit about that at the end of the...
Oh, sure.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Now let's move on to the anti-federalist eagles. I did see on one of these videos, an easy way for people to remember is that anti-federalist begins with an A, just like the word against. That means they were against the U.S. Constitution and a strong central government. Okay? The federalist begins with the letter F, like four. So that's an easy way. I thought, okay, this is a junior high school teacher. So that's a good way for people to remember. I still use all those tricks whenever I can.
That's as far as I got in school. So,
so it's very relative. So, again, as we all know, that they feared that. So even though they fired that first shot with Z, putting out that first essay, they're starting to play defense because it looks like the Federalists were well organized. They probably had a little bit more scratch to spend since they were coming from a little bit more wealth. And it put the anti-federalist eagles on the defense. And again, you can't sadly match them up essay for essay because that's not how they were written.
They weren't like rebuttal to one. They were pushed out.
From what the historians have revealed, that some you can, some many you can't. So it's a big task, and they don't even bother. But before I forget, I want to take a look at, we said Z. Might go to the National Archives to see if I can find something about Z. All right. Hang on here. I got to write it down, or I'll forget. So, okay, to help the anti-federalist agree with the U.S. Constitution, they fought for a Bill of Rights, which are the first 10 amendments, and we discussed those over the past several weeks. And they got their way. And the first 10 amendments were added. What I'm hoping to do is we're getting close to the end of tax season on April 15th, a couple weeks away. What I'd like to do, if we could, is like wrap up the 11th, 12th, 13th, 14th, 15th amendments before tax season. And that Saturday, the 14th, before April 15th, talk about the famous 16th Amendment. So we'll take a, my favorite.
Which was never ratified, right?
So I hear.
Okay.
So I hear,
good.
And so I've read, So who knows? It's there and never ratified, but it's there and it's being used for 100 plus years. So going back to the anti-federalist, some famous names that we talked about. Sam Adams was an anti-federalist, so he was opposing his cousin John Adams, who was a federalist. And we talked about George Mason, and they did end up getting the Bill of Rights ratified as an attachment almost to the Constitution in December of 1791. So it was 4 years after the original Constitution was signed. It was signed in September of 1787, so it took them a good 4 years to get everything settled. What other things can we talk about? Again, as far as the plays go, they used the newspapers of their days. We're talking about the major. Do you know what the two biggest states back then were as far as population goes? Virginia was one of them.
And New York was probably
in New York. So those were the major players, New York and Virginia, back in those days. So if everybody is agreeable here, maybe we should get back to the U.S. Constitution and pick up with the 11th and 12th Amendments. What do you think?
Sure.
You got any thoughts? Comments?
Okay. So You're saying by the 15th of April, you want to be dealing with the 16th. So it sounds like we're going to be going out of order.
You're unless that, you or we're going to talk real fast.
14, 15 all 1 week.
Well, you know, you almost can do those in 1 week because they're known as the ABC amendments that came around after the Civil War, okay, during Reconstruction, and they are related. And I think they were passed very close to each other chronologically.
Okay.
Okay, so that's the way I always remembered them, as the ABC. A, abolished slavery. B, you were born free if you were born in this country. And C, I forgot. I'll have to brush up with the C. Anybody know what C was? That's the 15th Amendment. Can vote. C.
So B has got to play a lot with that DACA then, right?
Yes, it does. It plays a lot with
when
DACA.
When was A, B, and C written?
It was after 1865. So it was during the Reconstruction.
The Lincoln, yeah.
So it was after the Civil War, probably, I think, between 1868 to the 1880s, maybe. I'll have to refresh my memory. I can't remember all these things. You know, and the older I get, the more it doesn't stick.
But basically, all three of them dealt with
Reconstruction after the Civil War,
right,
and doing away with slavery,
right,
and giving rights to. You hear a 14th Amendment used a lot these days because it extended the constitutional rights that we had to the states, where they were incorporated so that the states couldn't violate the U.S. Constitution either. Okay?
Right.
So, but that's coming. That's coming. So if we can, we'll just quickly hit the 11th and 12th, and I'll call it a...
Yeah, let's go.
All right. Okay, so the 11th, that came around in 1795. A good source for reading up on these amendments, and you can also see opposing commentary, is a website called constitutioncenter.org. That's all one word, constitutioncenter.org. The 11th Amendment limited lawsuits from a citizen of a different state against a state that he did not live in. Okay? The famous case that they use is Chisholm versus Georgia. And it also, this 11th Amendment altered some of the original Constitution. It changed Article 3, Section 2 of the original Constitution. So remember, that's what amendment can do that. You know, you can't just pull it out, but you can amend it. Okay? So roughly what this lawsuit said is that Chisholm was an individual, and I believe he was from the state of South Carolina, citizen of South Carolina. And during the War for Independence, which we commonly call the Revolutionary War, he provided some supplies to the state of Georgia, and he wanted reimbursement, and he wasn't getting satisfaction. So this citizen from South Carolina decided to sue the state of Georgia. And Georgia said, go ahead. We're not showing up because you have no standing. You can't sue us. So it went through the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court in this case decided in favor of Chisholm. So he did win the lawsuit. But after that, other following court cases said that we can't sue the states. The federal government can sue the states, so if you have a federal issue, you could go through the federal government to sue the states, but individuals and people from other nations can't sue a state. So I read this.
You can't do like Thornton versus New York?
Only if it's
criminal?
Only if they're violating a federal law. Then the federal government is behind you.
So Chisholm filed against Georgia in what state?
I think he made
federal.
It federal.
Right. right? Would have been federal.
Yeah, he probably started in South Carolina because that's where he resides. And then it went up to the federal level. So it probably stayed. It probably started in a federal district court, I would guess, is where it started.
It makes sense because you always hear about you can't file a lawsuit. You got to go down there to file a lawsuit or up there to file a lawsuit. So you can't. I'm not even sure you can do it, you know, even from maybe from county to county, but definitely state to state is a big thing.
Yeah, and as I was reading through this, it seems to me like the decisions after a while, they wouldn't even give you standing. So the Supreme Court didn't want to really deal with it. They stuck to, no, you can't sue a state if you're not living in the state. So same thing for somebody from a foreign country, a foreign agent is a term that they used. It was kind of back ping-ponging, back and forth. So I had a hard time following that one, too. I hate to admit it. I feel ignorant. But
you know, I got to make it modern again because there's this UN thing where they're always trying to sue us as either a nation or and make America pay, you know, for stuff. But you never hear about it being resolved. But the UN, people petition the UN against us. I don't know. I have to clear that up more.
I don't know how much time we have, but you really brought up another current topic because I don't know if you heard about the opinion piece that retired Supreme Court Justice, John Paul something,
Stevens.
Just wrote. I think it appeared in the New York Times. Maybe we can talk about that next week. But this guy sat on the Supreme Court. And his opinion is not very American on what the Supreme Court should do. It's not constitutional.
Who appointed him?
Good question. He's retired now. I'll have to look that up. I don't know. But it could be interesting to look at some of his thoughts. Well, let's move on to the 12th Amendment, which was ratified in 1804. In this one, we're going to make this real short and sweet because it deals with the Electoral College. And I'm not going to go into it. It's one of the most lengthy amendments in our U.S. Constitution. So for the convenience of time, I'm not really going to go into it other than to say that it was changed by the 20th Amendment. So when we get to the 20th Amendment, which was ratified in 1933, then we'll go in depth with this one. But as you can see, looking at my pocket constitution, it covers almost as much as one of the essays here as far as what it does. And let's safely say that back when it first started, if you received the most votes from the Electoral College, you became the president. If you received the second most votes, you became the vice president. But that caused some trouble. And it didn't stay that way for long because
because people from one party were having to work with people from another party because sometimes the Republican became president and the Democrat became the vice president or vice versa.
Yes, correct. Yeah. Correct. And I guess they just couldn't work together.
Imagine that. Gee, how different it is today.
Terrible. And I think I'll stop there. But you're right. You know, John Adams, who we know was a Federalist, he was elected president in 1796. It just so happened his vice president, do you know who his vice president was?
No.
John Adams' vice president was Thomas Jefferson, who was an anti-federalist. So they were good friends at one time, and then they became good enemies for a period of time. And it just so happens that those two guys passed away on the same day. And it was July 4th, 1825, I believe it was. So they became friends again in their later years. And it wasn't easy because one guy was from the Boston, Massachusetts area. The other guy was from Virginia. So, but that's really all I have for today.
Was that the, did we go over the amendments?
Yeah, we did. Yeah, you were busy. You were busy taking care of business, which is good. I mean, that's what you're supposed to do. You are in business. This is Iron Mike's Military Exchange. He does sell products here.
Don't say the name, but I was having a text with...
Oh, dear.
Okay.
All right. See, it is. It's work-related.
that's how important I am.
Good.
What time is it there?
Did you get that on your camera stuff?
No, I didn't. Good.
Okay.
I was just texting someone in Congress while we were doing the
thank
show.
Thank you. Isn't that cool to have that at your fingertips?
You're special.
Oh, was it? Really?
Oh, I'm special. Special like Courtney.
Interesting. All right, let me just do a quick update if you want. Thank you to Brad here, Brad Hamilton, right? With his fancy technology, we found out that John Paul Stevens was born in 1920, served on the Supreme Court from 1975 until he retired in 2010, and he was appointed by Gerald Ford, I believe I saw. Nominated by Gerald Ford. Nominated by in office Richard Nixon again. United States Court of Appeals.
That was when he was nominated to the
appeal. Oh, I see. It's going backwards. Gotcha. That's the most recent one. All right. So he was nominated to the U.S. Supreme Court by President Gerald Ford. So, and that was back in 1975, it looks like. So he served to 2010. What's that? That's quite
35
years. 35
years.
That's a long time. Yep, long time. Remember, they are appointed for life unless some – they can be impeached, which I don't know if that's ever happened. But if they do something criminal, they can be impeached. For example, if they murdered somebody or – no, I don't think it's been used. So, okay.
But they can choose to step down.
Yes, they can. Yes. There. And some are thinking that what's her nickname now? RBG, Ruth Bader Ginsburg. There are some people are wishing that she would step down. Yeah, she's another interesting one.
She's someone that falls asleep all the time.
She does fall asleep on occasion. She also believes that international courts should be a reference for her decisions.
Uh-uh.
Yep, she does. So that's questionable. Tim's working away there, so should we just fill in?
That was Civil War Radio, unless you have any more current topics, politics?
I'm
anything
winded.
Anything else to throw in there? Okay. And this is Civil War Radio. Go ahead, Armin.
I have one quote that I have to read.
I thought you were going to plug something, but go ahead.
No, it's James Madison in Federalist 51. This is probably one of the most famous quotes. And I had to bring the book so I don't mess it up. If men were angels, no government would be necessary. If angels were to govern men, neither external nor internal controls on government would be necessary. In framing a government which is to be administered by men over men, the great difficulty lies in this. You must first enable the government to control the governed. In the next place, oblige it to control itself. A dependence on the people is no doubt the primary control on the government. But experience has taught mankind the necessity of auxiliary precautions. The necessity of auxiliary precautions. So you better be ready, basically, for people to mess up.
Yeah.
That's what I get out of it.
You know what I got to say about these gentlemen that formed our independence and formed our Constitution and our amendments? You know, they were probably blessed in a way that their education is based on everything from that point backwards in history. So think of all the good literature, the really strong knowledge, the debate of humanity, democracy, the republic, you know, and everything else that goes with, like, dictatorships and, you know, being a king or a queen or whatever. But it wasn't clouded with the politics of today. It wasn't clouded. I mean, I don't even think Marxism was a thought. It may be back then, but it couldn't have been very big. That would be questionable, right?
But
point is that
1850s, give or take. 1850s? Yeah.
All right, so there could have been a little bit of that too then. But and that's okay because, let's face it, Marxism on paper is great.
Mm-hmm.
It's real life that it doesn't work.
Right.
But there wasn't clouded with our politics of today. You know, gender and, I don't know, everything, you know, confusing it. And so they didn't have to deal with all of that. They could deal with that knowledge of, who knows, Socrates, Plato, people like that. So how were they not brilliant men, not clouded or confused by all the stuff that we have to think about today? So if I had to restudy and start my life over, that's what I would do. I would do, instead of having a man cave, I'd go back to having the den, mm-hmm. where I had literature to read and understand right up to that point. Because just by those words.
Yeah.
That guy was that guy. What was it?
James Madison.
James Madison. Yeah. I would just point out by that one quote that he was a God-fearing, very intelligent man that understood humankind.
Yeah.
And its fallacies.
They're probably pretty decent role models, I would think. Somebody that you might want to know more about so you can model your life similar.
Right. But well learned.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
I mean, they had institutions.
Yeah, we mentioned last week that some of them went to New York College, which became Columbia, and another guy went to Princeton. I think it was Madison that went to Princeton, and might have been Hamilton that went to Columbia, New York College. So, yeah, they had institutions back then that higher learning, institutions of higher learning, yeah.
Yeah, fantastic. Yeah. Okay, Civil War Radio, and we'll be right back after these messages. And then I'll let you know who's next on the show, because I don't know.
Too much.
This radio program is for the men and women who stand in Arctic cold, on windswept deserts, knee-deep in rice paddies, enduring privation, physical misery, withering hostile fire, defending American liberty and protecting your lives with their own. From the past generations of global wars to the sacrifices of our servicemen and women. But Corporal Tim Thorne proudly presenting the Military Exchange Radio Show on the Combat Radio Network. As a veteran of the Gulf War and Somalia, graduate of the Military Police Academy, the School of Infantry, Jungle Expert Survival Training, and Korea's Mountain Warfare School, and primary marksmanship instructor, Stone Bay Camp Lejeune, Tim is proud to speak for veterans of every conflict from World War II to Afghanistan and Iraq. Now, join us for news, information, entertainment, politics, and respect and admiration for our brothers and sisters in uniform. Here is Corporal Tim Thornton and the Military Exchange.
The Military Exchange.
Welcome to the Military Exchange Talk Show. This is another segment of Three Men and a Microphone as we're following Civil War Radio. As you can see, we're building up the show with quite a few new segments. I'm going to read to you some awesome and outstanding stories and news events that I caught this week that I think you'll enjoy. Mattis accuses Russia of attempted murder of a man and his daughter following UK nerve agent attack. This article, written by Alex Hollings, read by Corporal Tim Thorne. On Monday, the United States announced that it would be joining the growing list of vexed nations expelling Russian diplomats and officials from their borders, following the use of a Soviet-era nerve agent on a former Russian spy on British soil. With 60 Russians being ordered out of the United States and at least 40 more from the 18 European nations and Canada, the exodus of Kremlin officials headed back to Moscow is perhaps not unprecedented, but historic nonetheless, and on Tuesday, American Secretary of Defense James Mattis did not mince words regarding his stance on the topic. On March 4th, a Soviet-produced nerve agent known as Novichok is believed to have been used in the attempted assassination of former Russian military intelligence officer turned MI6 informant Sergei Skripal exposure to the weapon left both Scripple and his 33-year-old daughter in critical condition, along with the first responding officer in the shopping square of Salisbury, England. At least 30 others ultimately had to seek treatment following exposure to the substance that the international community has claimed came from Soviet labs. Russia, however, has countered with a number of contradicting claims, all placing the blame for the incident on someone else. According to Mattis, there's little question as to who was responsible for the attack. When it came up during a press briefing on Tuesday, he referred to the incident as the Russian. Pretty obvious. Russia use of a weapon of mass destruction, a chemical agent, for the first time in Europe since World War II. When asked to clarify what he thought had happened in England, Mattis replied, attempted murder of a man and his daughter. How's that for starters? Mattis, who has pulled no punches in the past when characterizing Russia as a threat to the United States, lamented Russia's role as a constant antagonist on the global stage. He recounted a time when it seemed as though relations between Russia and the United States might even improve. I think a number of us with my color hair can remember Russia Marines in North Carolina working with U.S. Marines as we prepared for possible deployments together on U.N. peacekeeping missions. Humanitarian relief, Mattis said. That, regrettably, by Russia's choice, is now a thing of the past. He went on to call the use of the nerve agent in Salisbury, England, reckless, using it as an example of Russia's choice to seek a different relationship with the NATO nations, as opposed to a mutually beneficial one. According to the Defense Secretary, the assassination attempt in Salisbury was just one example of a broader foreign effort. They take insignia off soldiers' uniforms and they go into Crimea. They say they have nothing to do with what's going on with the separatists in eastern Ukraine. I'm not sure how they can say that with a straight face. They point out that it can't be proven who had tried to kill the person in Salisbury, he listed. They're doing things they believe are deniable.
Springtime weather forecast. Rainy, gray skies with a slight chill in the a.m. Tactical to practical. Military rain gear on sale now at the Military Exchange in Canandaigua, New York. Camouflage rubber rain pants. USGI issue, only $19.99.
The Military Exchange.
When you hear the phrase, boots on the ground, that phrase means our men and women that are in the American Armed Forces. And that means they're ready to fight. They wear the very best gear America has to offer. I'm talking the very best in leather, Gore-Tex, Finsulate, three-layer Vibram soles, Nomex, side zippers, and stitching. Quality that the civilian market can't even come close to offering. When you say quality, you want U.S. government issue. Iron Mike's is the leading distributor for military government contractors. They offer jump boots, Mickey boots, jungle boots, SWAT boots, sniper boots, steel toe, Navy deck boots, and Marine Corps and Army desert boots. Corafram low quarter shoes, mucklucks, extreme cold weather, and lightweight tactical boots in 6, 8, and 10 inches. Iron Mike's takes trade-ins of all your old military boots. Iron Mike's is located at 2485 State Route 332 in Canandaigua. Check us out online at ironmikes.co.
This article is written by Alex Hollings, read by Corporal Tim Thorne. Earlier this year, SpaceX announced that construction was already underway on what is to become the company's new flagship rocket and space-faring vessel. The BFR, according to the company's founder, Elon Musk, the BFR, short for Big Falcon Rocket, will be capable of ferrying large crews to and from distant locations like Mars, seemingly making the possibility of a Mars colony attainable for the first time in history. The motivations that drive Musk's various endeavors are sure to be as diverse as the endeavors themselves, but Musk revealed at least one of the driving forces behind his goal to colonize both Mars and the Moon in a recent talk he delivered during the SCSW Festival, and it's not an optimistic one. Musk believes it's important humanity has colonies on other celestial bodies to help ensure the species can recover from the next global war. Last century, we had two massive world wars. Three, if you count the Cold War, Musk explained to the crowd in Texas. I think it's unlikely that we'll never have another world war again. In June of last year, Musk unveiled his plan to make humanity a multi-planetary species. Using the Interplanetary Transport System launched BFR platform, unlike the recent test launch of the SpaceX Falcon Heavy, the BFR won't simply be the most powerful rocket in use anywhere on the planet. It will be the most powerful rocket ever launched when it comes to fruition. While Musk has addressed other concerns about the long-term survival of the species, including asteroid strikes, climate shifts, and even artificial intelligence, the threat that seemed most looming to Musk this month was a possibility that what's left of humanity could be thrown into a new Dark Ages. Following warfare on a global scale, his hope is that established bastions of humanity located nearby on the moon and Mars could help draw the survivors back into the 21st century. Then we want to make sure that there's enough of a seed of human civilization somewhere else to bring civilization back and perhaps shorten the length of the Dark Ages, Musk said. I think a moon base and a Mars base that could perhaps help regenerate life back here on Earth would be really important, and to get that done before a possible World War III. With tensions ever rising between the United States and growing threats Russia and China, as well as seemingly innumerable small conflicts percolating around the world that could lead to a cascade of alliances and declarations of war, a third world war is, for the first time since the end of the Cold War, starting to feel entirely possible again. That's bad news for Musk and for humanity, as the technological hurdles that need to be overcome to establish such colonies remains daunting. Musk tempered his concerns about global war, however, with a reminder that it isn't only the only thing that could change life on Earth in a dramatically negative way. Before closing out his remarks, he turned his attention back to another concern that may sound more like science fiction than the boogeyman one might expect would keep the successful entrepreneur up at night: artificial intelligence. According to Musk, develop AI is no less dangerous than building nuclear weapons. In fact, it's worse. The danger of AI is much greater than the danger of nuclear warheads, by a lot, and nobody would suggest that we allow anyone to just build nuclear warheads if they want. That would be insane, he said. If humanity collectively decides that creating digital superintelligence is the right move, then we should do so very, very carefully. Very, very carefully, Musk added. This is the most important thing that we can possibly do.
And now, a moment of bliss, courtesy of Iron Mike's Military Exchange and Camping Supply.
My Wooby, you swept me off my feet and put into my heart such fiery heat. At first sight, I would not have known the kind of warmth and protection I'd be shown. You've helped me through the good and bad. For being issued you, I am so glad. You are my warmth and soulmate, and we both know that it's fate. Forever, I will hold you tight. Because of you, I know I'll never be cold. I'm yours, and you are mine. Forever and ever, we'll be just fine. And on the eighth day, God created the poncho liner, and the infantry was very thankful.
The American-made military-issue poncho liner, available in assorted colors along with the USGI poncho to create a ranger bag. Available at Iron Mike's Military Exchange, Route 332, Canandaigua. Visit online at ironmikes.co.
Frankly, I am offended that you are offended. This article was written by C. Daniel Bezier, read by Corporal Tim Thorne. The Holy Cross Knights will no longer be known as such. Word has it that to be a knight is now offensive. Someone should inform the Cape Crusader that being a dark knight makes him a hate monger who supports Christian violence against Muslims. The college announced on Thursday it would drop its knight mascot and related imagery to avoid ties to the violence committed by Christian armies during the Crusades. The Massachusetts school's president, Reverend Philip Burroughs, said in a letter to students that the visual depiction of a knight in conjunction with the moniker Crusader inevitably ties us directly to the reality of the religious wars and the violence of the Crusades. There was also an ad by Australian beer company Rusty Yak that was forced to be taken down because it offended people with red hair. My sister, is a ginger, and she personally thought it was hilarious. But I suppose there is a chance that some lucky bastard out there with a unique and frankly gorgeous mane of hair would not have countenanced such an attack on their looks. Full disclosure, I am jealous. I've always wanted to be a redhead. A brief history of political correctness. The buzzwords first appeared as a pejorative tossed around between neocons and liberals in the early 1990s. Politically correct, the left calls it a tactic of the right to feign courage when choosing not to give up lechery and racism. I read that this week in another op-ed, and I cringed. The same op-ed suggested Americans should replace the words political correctness with conscience, and then it would make more sense why attacking the very idea of PC culture is wrong and hateful. The article also slogged on through a thick layer of its own smugness to blame PC shaming on Donald Trump. Now I've heard it all. Trump is officially responsible for every single thing that happens anymore, good, bad, and worse, except that being irritated about having to bow to PC norms has been around my entire adult life, when most people outside of New York City had no idea who Trump even was. It's common to hear the right complain about PC and the left complain about the complaint about PC. Meanwhile, those of us who live in reality, that huge swath of people existing somewhere in the middle, we just want to be free to say what we truly believe and have the same courtesy given to us. Courtesy, it's a funny word. PC makes itself the courtesy police because in defending it, you often hear it is based in the importance of empathy or protecting marginalized people. It is a nice attempt at appealing to emotion, but there is something far more sinister at work here. Let's take a look at the history of PC, which actually predates even the Clinton years. Professor Frank Ellis at the University of Sheffield noted the term political correctness was first used in the late 19th and early 20th century when Vladimir Lenin began his rise to power. Ellis said that Marxist-Leninist and Maoist placed a heavy preeminence on being ideologically correct, both politically and theoretically, essentially a forum for discussion. As Ellis described it, it would impede the revolutionary spirit needed to upend the social order. You heard that correctly. Political correctness was born out of a communist socialist desire to control free speech and encourage right thinking. Perhaps PC culture is more widely accepted today because communism is more widely accepted today. The frog has been boiling in that pot of water for far too long. In a 20th century Europe, the Frankfurt School of Critical Theory was born in Germany. Author William Lynn noted that it was the intellectuals who believed culture needed to be rooted out before it could be replaced by a Marxist one. Two Marxist theorists, Antonio Gramsci in Italy and George Lukács in Hungary, independently came up with the same answer. They said that Western culture and the Christian religion had so blinded the working class to its true Marxist class interest that communism was impossible in the West until traditional culture and Christianity were destroyed. Their solitary goal was to destroy old ways of thinking. In other words, they were progressive thinking. Progressive always sounds good because it implies moving forward. But at the expense of what? While the right tends to adhere itself to rule of law and tradition, the left champions equalitarianism. It all sounds good on paper, it truly does. But to date, no country that has attempted to make such a utopia has succeeded, and millions upon millions have died to conduct such political and social experiments. Just ask the starving masses, currently at each other's throats to simply survive the days in Venezuela. And in advance of a rebuttal, the Nordic model is not some outlier example of a raging socialist success. In short, the Scandinavian countries are not socialist or democratic socialist, if you prefer that Bernie buzzword. In the Scandinavian countries, like all other developed nations, the means of production are primarily owned by private individuals. not the community or the government, and resources are allocated to their respective uses by the market, not governed or community planning. While it is true that the Scandinavian countries provide things like a generous social safety net and universal health care, an extensive welfare state is not the same thing as socialism. What Sanders and his supporters confuse as socialism is actually social democracy, a system in which the government aims to promote the public welfare through heavy taxation and spending within the framework of a capitalistic economy. That is what the Scandinavians practice. Even the Prime Minister of Denmark acknowledged the difference, saying, "I know that some people in the U.S. associate the Nordic model with some sort of socialism. Therefore, I would like to make one thing clear. Denmark is far from a socialist planned economy. Denmark is a market economy." But I digress, as I tend to do. So where were we, eh? Ah, yes, the roots of PC culture in America. Critical theory made its way across the pond and took root in the 1950s and 1960s, with Herbert Marcuse translated the work of the other Frankfurt School thinkers into books college students could understand, such as Eros and Civilization, which became the Bible of the New Left in the 1960s. The idea was there, seething underneath in the shadows, but finally gained widespread prominence in the early 1990s when it was packaged and sold as the tolerant and compassionate way to speak to and about our fellow man. Wait, I'm sorry. Saying man is not politically correct of me because it leaves out women. But then women spelled that way still carries the men within it. Perhaps I should say the compassionate way to speak about our fellow humankind, unless that leaves out the animals. I give up. And you get the point. So that's the dirty secret of the PC movement. It's Marxist. But calling it Marxist is not palatable to the average American. So we dress it up as something else entirely. The late great George Carlin probably said it best when he now famously explained that political correctness is fascism pretending to be manners. Now I appreciate the fascism and Marxism exist at opposite poles of the political spectrum, but I think most would agree we would prefer to live in neither of those worlds. Why do I abhor political correctness? Not because I am some far-right-leaning, hate-filled, racist, sexist, homophobe. In fact, I couldn't be further from those things. I abhor it because we are being systematically conditioned to get offended at everything these days. And if we are offended at everything, we cease to recognize those things which we should truly be offended. People become enraged every day about things they read online, hear in the news, or witness on social media, about topics ranging from the words people use to gender politics, race, sports, teams, body image, parenting styles, and on it goes. I realize that whether it be in articles, videos, conversations, or comments online, this was becoming a collective norm. We are systematically being taught not to consider someone else's feelings by always considering someone else's feelings. Rather than ban something or someone that we find offensive, why not preach real tolerance? Why not use that experience to understand why someone may say or do the things they do or question why it bothers us in the first place? Instead of looking at the deeper question and choosing to understand, we're being taught simply to react and tell people they are right or wrong, which in essence changes nothing. Free speech and the thought is fraught with dangers because some chucklehead is bound to say something rude or hurtful. It's unavoidable. But having to second guess every single thought we may have stifles any creativity and passion we may truly feel. It prevents us from being thoughtful for fear of not being well thoughtful. Such a horrible catch-22. So what comes next, I have to wonder, should all sports teams just throw in the towel and be known as the Green Bay football team or the Cleveland baseball team? I didn't use the Browns because that would have been the Cleveland, not really a football team. Just kidding, dog pound. Don't send me hate mail. I know y'all are tough enough to take a joke. But seriously, I didn't mean to offend you. And see, that's how it begins.